grew up in Mexico, and she actually very quickly became a so-called, like I would call it, metropolitan nomad. She studied in the art center in Pasadena, and after her graduate, and she studied the traditional art of photography, which means the art of photography specializing in architectural photography as a technique, which I guess the art center has been specialized on in all the great memories of Schulman, and I don't know like how they relate to all this. After her graduation, I don't think that she regarded herself as a pure architectural photographer. She began to photograph for a lot of different magazines. But she particularly embraced the ones who were still open to photography, which illuminated people, places, situations, not necessarily purely in order to exhibit objects for consumption. Don't get me wrong, Livia has photographed for any who is who in the magazine world and advertisement, from Shia Day to I do not what, but her larger projects and exhibitions keep actually our undivided, I would say, attention, and we often wouldn't necessarily find her quickly in all of the other many, many different diverse activities which she's done. Her first book, which was in 2008, and now I'm so good in Spanish, Enanitos Toreros, on bullfighter dwarfs, were photographs and interviews which she has done, published in Powerhouse and Books in New York. And we have this book also on display, and I'm sure we've seen some project today, where she was following a particular group of other interesting nomads, which I think bullfighter dwarfs are, and their daily lives, and their and was capable of creating an entirely different picture and a system of representation of these wonderful individuals. This book has become an instant success. And without necessarily planning so, it was, again, not a sole direct trajectory in her career, but she started to become, after that, more and more involved in architectural photography. So the second book, which we will see today, a lot of photographs, at the Hotel Gallery, is from 2009, and it's called Of People and Houses, Photographs of Livia Corona. It was edited by Ilka and Andreas Ruby, and it was one of the books when it came out and I got it in my hand, I was like, I went like, the way how she looked at architecture immediately represented the new idea how our younger generation were thinking about architecture. So the way how she photographed architecture in the end became quite a kick in our derriere, I think, in many cases. Livia has received numerous awards, and what is quite interesting is like where they all come from. I think even in 2010, the first one is from Amsterdam, KLM Paul Hoof Award. There's a nomination at the UK, there's the International Photography Awards winner, which is in the United States, and there's another Sony World Photography Awards in Cannes, in France. So you could imagine that she is, at that point, definitely a clearly global player. And there are many, many more awards, which she's received right after she already graduated from the Art Center. Mexico, United States again, the Red Bull Energy Award, United States, that one is always an interesting one. But also like scholarships and actually a German one as well, that one is a funny one, the BMW Inszenierte Kraft World Prize for Young Photographers. There are numerous catalogs which are in claim, for example, Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis by Al Gore, visions in which were published actually in Palma de Mallorca. There were like people in the Institute of Cervantes in Madrid. There are different kinds of exhibitions and catalogs and which were happening at the same time in Berlin and in Rotterdam. And I particularly like this particular nice title, which was exhibited in a catalog in Columbia University, which is Life Size, Everything Beautiful is a Contradiction. She's given talks in, you know, in Sittelkassel, in Austria, in architecture, the House of Architecture in Graz, of course, in Brazil, in New York, and so forth. The selected list of magazines, which I think is quite an interesting one, one which I think you must have been quite involved in, are like magazines from New York Times Magazine to Domus to Life Magazine, Travel and Leisure, less interesting but very interesting to us. And I think where there's a big change already has started in the change of architectural culture is Dwell, which I think you've been quite in. Which was very, very consciously trying to transform the imagery of architecture through the way how they published and photographed architecture as the first ones many, many years ago. And that, I would say, is an important point, which I think is important to us to really enter this discussion, which I think photographers have finally entered aggressively into a situation where they were like not willing to look at architecture anymore in the traditional modernist kind of genre, but have entirely transformed the way how you look at architecture, and with that have transformed hopefully our possibility, the way how we look at architecture. So with this, please help me welcome Livia Corona.
Thank you, Dagmar, for such a generous introduction. I think of myself more as a portrait photographer. I studied fine art and photography at Art Center, and I never thought that I would be shooting architecture, except I had a very nice teacher who spoke very calmly. His name was Paul Bielenberg, and he kept giving me A's. And I thought, oh, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can use a 4x5 in this way that I can photograph these majestic buildings. And then I kind of lost interest in it because it seemed very mechanical to me, the way that that I was being taught, because of the way that I was being taught to look at architecture. I thought there wasn't something in there for me, because I always liked or preferred the interaction with people, and I think like the more anthropological experience of life is something that I find very fulfilling or life-redeeming in a way. And so I'll show you at the end of the visuals that I'm going to show you how I started, how I got into architectural photography. It was kind of accidental. It was someone else who noticed that I could do this, and I had been doing it through my personal work, but I just hadn't thought that I could do it for commissions. But my first project, it was a 10-year project. It was a series of portraits and interviews that resulted in that book on individuals with dwarfism who work as the famous dwarf bullfighters of Mexico. I met a woman who's traveling with this group, and she's actually a registered nurse. Her parents are teachers, and she was born with dwarfism, and she finds a very hard time getting jobs. You know? So she joined this group that travels around Mexico, and when I met her, I was traveling around, and she invited me to just travel with her and her group. And as I was shooting that project, it was 10 years of hanging out with them. I was also just finishing Art Center, and I started putting a portfolio together. They're pretty good at that school at helping you make a living as you're pursuing your own personal work as an artist. So, and as a way to finance my own projects, I would take commissions, and I still do, from magazines, and write off the bat at Art Center. I got this award from PDN. It's a photo magazine that I think now with blogs it's probably not as relevant, because there's so many voices now and putting a sort of certificate of like, okay, this is like the USDA, you know, this is good meat. Like PDN at that time would select like 30 up and coming photographers. So I got that award, and from then I started getting all these commissions. And out of that award, I was contacted by Architecture Magazine. This is in 2001, when Architecture Magazine was a bit more experimental and less interested in the trade of architecture, but more in the culture of surrounding architectural buildings. And they called me in because they wanted me to photograph Hollywood and Highland. It's an architectural project in Los Angeles that is kind of designed to be photographed. It's where they hold, where the Kodak Theater exists and where they hold the Oscars every year. So it has a lot of camera-ready angles, but it also is problematic in certain ways. So they wanted someone who would approach it more like a documentary photographer, and that's where I came in. I began shooting architecture for these publications, and at the same time, some of my own projects started more and more focusing on how architecture interacted with the people who used the building. And I started shooting, my interest was more in portrait work, so little by little I noticed, and I probably didn't realize this until about maybe 3 years ago, that what I was doing was thinking of, instead of doing environmental portraits, in photography, the environmental portrait, I'll explain it very briefly, is where you take the individual and you put them in their environment, like their work environment, to get a sense of what they do. Like those, I don't know if you guys know, that, like August Sander, those famous German photographs of the butcher holding a slab of beef, or the bricklayer holding a stack of bricks. So the main character is the individual, but what I started doing is becoming more and more interested in architecture as the main character. So the supporting cast were the people who were using the building. So my approach to making the architectural photograph was a combination, a little bit of instinct and background research. And I started just talking to people who lived in buildings, and talking to the neighbors of new buildings, talking to the architects who have put certain buildings together, and asking people about their experience living in certain types of homes, as in the case you see here. So there's a lot of field work involved, I think, in the way that I like to work. But it all comes back to the photograph as a way to try and share that in the way that I know how to communicate. And in some cases, the photographs are a celebration of what the architects have accomplished or what the dwellers, I'm interested a lot in architecture without architects. And so in one way, it celebrates architecture, whether it's done by a professional or by a contractor or just by the home. And in other cases, the photographs are an ode to what is missing, or just a recognition of a plan that was proposed but didn't happen. Sometimes when I shoot the photographs, I direct people after interviewing them or just having long conversations. I ask them to pose in a way that illustrates certain topics of the conversation. In this photograph, for example, the house is so reduced that they told me that when they have company, the stairway becomes a sitting area for talking to guests. In this case, I'm at the other end of the wall taking the photographs. So I'm not so much interested in architecture as, say, a product, the way that I think one of the ways that architecture was getting photographed for a long while was as an item to be purchased. And if you look at a lot of older architectural photography, there's a sort of rendering type of quality in the imagery. And I think it's just how we've grown as photographers that I think maybe the novelty of the rendering is what the photographers were trying to emulate in the way that they directed the photographs. But I was more interested in the visual analysis of architecture as a whole. Again, the main character, but trying to tell as full a story as possible. So I'm interested in it in architecture as a as a as an individual, you know, like the main character of influence in a movie, and the photos of the people that are being shot within the architect just kind of tell what the experience of living in some developments or in some types of homes are. So the photos there, it's a little bit of sociology and talk about history and politics and mimesis and the effect of our surroundings on our lives. So I'll blast through some of these images. And the project that I've been showing is from a series I'm working on. It's called 2 Million Homes from Mexico, and the name is a play on Dan Graham's project, Homes for America, where I think the focus of that project was more on this was more abstract, and but in the case of 2 Million Homes from Mexico, it's I think it's a little more sociological, definitely, than the Dan Graham approach to Homes for America. But it also that title also overlaps with the promise made by President Fox in the year 2000, or the year 1999, when he was campaigning for the presidency of Mexico. One of his running platforms was that he would build 2 million homes during his 6-year term. And he did achieve them, but in a way, he did achieve the promise, actually. I believe the total is 2,300,000, but in the prototype that I've shown you of identical homes repeating in endless rows. And little by little, I've been working on that project for 5 years, and little by little, I've been seeing people adapt the homes, and it's the one thing within the project that gives me hope about these repeating backdrops as places for younger generations to grow up in. In this case, the dwellers bought a house and converted it into a castle after the man of the house taught himself AutoCAD and designed the castle after watching endless Disney movies with castles in them. And the wife dresses up as Snow White, and they rent the house on the weekends as a party hall, because there aren't many options available in the neighborhood. When the neighborhoods are built, there are no places allotted for civic interaction. There are no event halls. There are no churches. I'm not a very religious person, but I think for Mexico, you kind of acknowledge that so much of the family interaction comes out of seven sacraments, like marriage, baptism, First Communion. There's always parties that revolve around these religious events, regardless of how religious you are, and that these new developments, which are actually new cities built on the outskirts, have removed a lot of these gathering places and just build row after row after row of cereal houses, I think is very significant for the future quality of life of these dwellers. For example, this house has been turned into a gym, as you see. And this is these are just film stills from a little video I made of a bread seller that goes around the neighborhood. And first I had thought that I would make a loop of the video, and then I realized I didn't need to make a loop because the developers already did that for me in repeating the same sequence. We traveled around the neighborhood for maybe 8 hours, and I cut the video down to 20 minutes, which I'm not going to show it to you, but it's on my website if you're interested. It's just too long to put you through that. I'm going to show you now from the photographs from the work that is up at Hartel Gallery now. This is from a book called Of People and Houses. It's a project that I worked on in collaboration with Ilka and Andreas Ruby, who invited me to do a sort of one-time residency, I suppose, in Graz, well, in Styria, the capital is Graz, that's where I was staying, but to view different recent architectural projects that would be selected, reduced to 12 of which would be selected for this book that chooses the 12 most interesting projects that happened in Styria in the past 2 years. So they put it out every 2 years. And when Andreas was approached by the, Andreas and Ilka were approached by the House of Architecture of Graz and were invited to do the catalog. And interestingly enough, it was from them, from Andreas and Ilka, that came the idea to have a single photographer that would communicate a single voice in the catalog, rather than a collection of product images taken by different architects. And what we set out to do was make photographs that would tell you, that would give you a certain narrative that would discuss aspects of the building itself, instead of just having you look at the building. That's something that would show you a little more about it. And again, there were interviews. There's actually interviews in the book. We'll have a copy over at the gallery. But the interviews in the book consider, for each project, the architect, financier, the neighbors, the people living in the building. All ages of people are interviewed. You have 8-year-old kids talking about how much they like their home. You have the neighbors saying it's a horrible home. You have the housewife saying this is the best thing that's ever happened. So the photographs talk a little bit about that. In this case, this is a building that that went up maybe 3 years ago in the city of Graz, and it's built in a street corner that borders a soup kitchen. So many people, especially elderly people, come to the soup kitchen for the services it provides. But now that this glossy, shiny building opened up with a spa and a cafe, bistro, and an artist resident dorms are above. There's also studios for advertising agencies. So now you have another kind of person using the space. So we made a photograph setup that has to do with the uses. So, and again, these are all the people that appear in the photographs are all not necessarily models, but they're people from Styria who we invited to participate and directed to reenact a role that would communicate something about the building. Here is an inside view of the building, and it's a very utopic achievement, I think, this building, because of the ability of the architect to get the government to donate funds to make the building, and allot some of it to low-income housing as well as artists and businesses. They achieved a very good balance. And some of the photographs that I do, that I did for this case in particular, there's maybe 3 or 4 out of 100 that very deliberately reference very well-known photographs from the past with the purpose of taking that filter. If you think of the composition of a pre-existing photograph and you recreate it and you replace it in current terms, I think for me, it just makes me kind of think of the gap in between, the time gap between the original photograph. This is after a photograph by Eugene Smith. I think it's called Walk into Paradise Garden, and it's a photograph of his kids that he photographed. He was a war photographer, and he had seen so much violence, and then came back home and photographed his kids walking through the trees. It's a very famous black and white photograph. And for him, it was a photograph full of hope, and I think in this case, I wanted to use some of the tropes to talk about how the utopic sensation you get when you're walking around this building. In this case, the photographs celebrate the achievements of an architect who tried very hard to make the building commissioned for. It's the one on my left, the one on this side. as you can see, the Finnish, what is this type of, is it Corian? No, what?
Cortine steel.
Cortine steel was used anticipating that it would oxidize in a shade that would almost perfectly match the buildings that exist in this town that borders Slovenia. It's a very old town called Bad Radkersburg. I got better at my pronunciation, but still. But tried very hard to blend itself, sort of like a friendly alien coming in and disguising itself as much as possible with the background. And I wanted to comment on that, so I asked one of the neighbors, the backyard neighbors, to this man in the blue shirt. I talked to him about whether he liked the building or not, and he said he did. And then I brought one of the architects that worked in the firm that made this building, and they had a conversation, and they met, and I photographed it. This is a sort of commemoration of that. In this case, you see one of the handymen who work in the building placed at the ledge, at the edge of the new building, what appears as if a climb into the roof is actually a roof that's across the street, but just because of perspective, it kind of blends in. But again, it's another way of acknowledging how the architect put some effort into this. I mean, to the point where even the volcanic gravel that was used to cover the roof that no one was going to see was also bought in just the right shade of red. And this is a little bit about just kind of imagining ways that one experiences a building, like the majestic view of a postcard window, which is very generous. In this case, this is another building called Rosemlin, and it's a story of a building. It's a building in the background that's black. And I'm very interested in the photo essay, just like the old tradition. It's a very 60s Life magazine technique of telling a story where you take 5-10 images, and you still see it in the New York Times every now and then. But I think that in the olden days, maybe Walker Evans was really good at it. But in olden days, there was a way of making photography that was almost like film stills. And in this case, I was very interested in how the architects tried to almost pay a penance for bringing in this building, the black building, into the neighborhood that was just getting gentrified. It's a neighborhood that's mainly inhabited by people from India who have come to Graz, and people from Turkey. So Turkish and Indians now living with wealthier, hipper Austrians that are living in the side of the neighborhood. So I thought that there was something metaphoric about the building painting itself in this black cloak, and some of the Muslim immigrants, some of the Muslim people that lived in the neighborhood. So we found some burqas, and we made a story around that, just kind of working with the metaphor of how when you wear a burqa, you keep your treasures, in a sense, on the inside, and which I think is what these two architects did for the house. So you see an inside view of the bathroom. You can tell that it's a bit more modernist. And on the bottom photograph on the left of the facade, you see there's a furniture store that has, it's more like that Capellini, Neo, Eames, Aero, Saarinen type of furniture design. But again, the house itself adopts this very demure, almost self-effacing gesture. This is another house, and this is a photograph that's set up. And it's not, what I do is I tell people it's a little bit like directing for motion, where you create a situation and then photograph around it. So we had talked to the owners, and they told us that they have, they go down, that's the house above, they go down to their garden, which is really just this gigantic hillside, sorry. And they have picnics, so we set up a picnic around it, and we wanted to celebrate, in a sense, how, unlike some of the recent architectural projects that we saw over there, in this case, the architect, who's the person in the back with his daughter in the blue shirt, he's friends with the client, what he did is build a house around the natural environment instead of build. He didn't commit that accident that some architecture you see in some places, not all, but in some cases, architecture or civic infrastructure that is designed to celebrate nature, I think, as a secondary effect, ends up destroying that very nature. And in this case, the architect placed the house in a way that was least intrusive, so that when you were in what is the wild garden mountainside of the house is not as imposing, it's just something in the background, and really it's just you with the natural landscape. The original idea for the house was to make the ceiling a greenhouse, but the city, and cover the whole roof with glass, the type of glass that you would use for a greenhouse. But the township did not allow it because, again, it's a town that was built in the 1800s, and it has more of a concern with keeping the whole aesthetic of the town in line with 1800s architecture. But now it's an enormous playroom for the kids, so we just brought them up there and staged that. And again, some of the photographs, like I said, re-envision classic architecture photographs. This is after a photograph of Team 10, but I wanted to stage it with kids from Austria who are taking an introduction to architecture class. And the one on the right is a reenactment of a, it's a photograph of Corbusier presenting the project of Chandigarh in India. And in this case, the kids were watching slides of Corbusier speaking, and we had placed them just to mimic that photograph. And then the photograph on the left, I think I came to that photograph because I started thinking about these photographs of gatherings of architects from an era when events were not overly documented. I think now, as you know, anyone who uses Facebook, if you go to your friends' photographs, you'll see maybe, if three of your friends went to a certain party, you'll see maybe 60 images from each person. Well, it depends on who your friends are, but I have very crazy people who just put all of the photographs that they shot of that night. And each person will put so many that you end up seeing maybe 600, I don't know how many, many views of a certain event. And in olden times, when architects got together, there was like one assigned photographer, and these photographs were made that tried to capture the moment. There's a couple, I was watching the slide projections in Sibley Hall, and there's a really beautiful one that I thought, oh, we should redo that one. And it's one of the teachers, I forgot the name already, I'm really bad with names, but talking to the students, and it's all men, and they're all wearing white shirts and black ties, and I think it's maybe one of those rare moments when maybe the assigned school photographer went in, and it looks almost directed. But I wanted to have I wanted to make a photograph that even though it's artificial, because we don't really need to be so formal in the way we pose for photographs now because they're so disposable, but I wanted to have a photograph that emulated one of those moments of coming together. These are all examples of how I experienced architecture when I was going through Austria. There's a lot of architecture that you only see from a car, like this house on the bottom left. You can only see it from the freeway. There's a private gate, so you can never go into it, even though we tried to get through the gate. On the middle bottom, again, it's an example of a infrastructure or urbanization that's extended into the wild Austrian greenery to better enjoy it, but in that sense, it kind of ruined a little bit of this area that's made for rappelling and bungee jumping. On the top right over here, this is an ode to an idea the architect proposed to the city but got denied. The architect wanted to have a park in this plaza that he designed. You see the kiosk on the left, and then this is the park. But the city really wanted to keep a thoroughway going there. So it's kind of a lost opportunity to have this bigger space. So the photographs just kind of, they're built on layers and layers and layers and layers. And we get these results. So that was of people in houses. I'll tell you very briefly, this is how I came to shoot my first architectural commission. Aside from the architecture magazine projects, there were a few. Johnston Markley, architects from Los Angeles, they teach at UCLA. They had built a house on the part of what was originally a Tom Main project in Bimorphosis in Venice Beach, and half of the house burnt down in a fire, and Johnston Markley was brought in to make a new house. And the house, the Tom Main house, was called 2468, and he built it on expanding multiples of the number 2. He had the windows 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, and the exterior of the house was painted in primary colors of red, yellow, and blue. And what Mark and Sharon of Johnston Markley did was take those parameters and reverse them. And here, instead of the exterior being a primary yellow, which I think the Tom Main house is, they made the house 18% gray, which is, in photography, the most primary version you could get of gray. And they brought the colors on the inside, and they used the same multiples, but they moved the windows to the side. They gave themselves the same, they corralled themselves with the same rules, but shifted them a little. So it made for a very interesting space that when I was invited to make an intervention, the house was empty, so the owner allowed Johnston Markley to use the space as a place for art exhibits and interventions. So they brought in 4 artists to do different pieces. They had a sound artist, and they had me as a photo artist. And what I was most intrigued in is how one would experience a house when these exact parameters that were passed on from Tom Main or from Morphosis to Johnston Markley, then to these imagined dwellers. So I hired retired film extras from Los Angeles and gave the wardrobe stylist the same parameters that Johnston Markley and Tom Main had, only the primary colors and only using multiples. And as you know, that some extras in Hollywood are, you know what they do, you know, they're in the background, they seldom get direction from the main director. There's usually the casting agent passing on very little details about the scene, and it's up to the extra to interpret it. And you see it a lot in sitcoms where the extras will be in the back having this sort of fake conversation or dancing out of beat. And in this case, the direction was also very little. And I knew that they would be able to work with that because that's what they had done professionally. And in some cases, I would say, well, okay, you're going to be walking around the house, and here's the model, and let's see what happens. You know, so they would come in, and they would try to understand the architecture better. Or in the case of these chairs, I would say, well, this is where the camera is going to be. And everyone would look through the camera and say, it's going to, you know, this is where the action is going to happen. So they would kind of pile up. So it was a collaboration between their sense of what they would do with the space and what I thought would tell a story about the space as experienced through the same mathematical settings. And here I'll show you a little bit about, and I need to, let me check the time, what we're doing. In 1998, I started the project. This is the book that came out 10 years later. And from there, that's when Architecture Magazine, after Hollywood and Highland, they had me photograph an LGBT center in San Francisco. And it was the last issue that Architecture Magazine published before the new management took over. And I think there was a lot of anger about the LGBT center getting featured. A lot of people canceled their subscription, or they sent back the magazine in tears. And it turned out that they actually did have a very conservative audience that they didn't know about. So from, I guess you can start, I don't know, I guess I was shooting architecture when I was shooting these guys. There's a bull ring. These are, the book has 100 images. I'm just going to show you a couple. This is the first time that we traveled together. The woman on the top of the station wagon is Isabel, who's my friend, my closest friend from this group and this time. And it was, this is the first day that we traveled together. And it was at this moment that I realized, wait a minute, there's something very wrong here, because what the promoter is selling is not actually the bullfight, but he's selling the appeal of the other by placing them on the rooftop of the car. I think that was the idea, was that that would be the main attraction, not so much a quality musical review. So I started the project little by little. I never thought that it would turn into a book. And then when I would talk to them, some of them would say, well, I really wish, like it's when, 2 years after is when President Fox had gotten elected, and there was a lot of hope in the country that many things would change, aside from housing, the housing problem. The members of the Dwarf Bullfighter Troop group were hoping that civil rights for people with disabilities would get more attention, and they didn't. Not much changed. Here we are in the bullring at night. It's not a very well-paid profession, but there aren't too many other options. There's a lot of downtime between performances. We would spend a lot of time just talking. The woman on the right, on the bed, the little girl, this is a year later. At a quinceañera, a coming of age party. It's a birthday. Backstage shots. So from there came architecture, and here we are. So thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, let me know.
So I guess my question stems from that, and it's due to many observations or interactions that might have stemmed from these photographs. Whenever like we design something, a lot of times we get caught up in the narrative of the space and the performance of the space and the subsequent use or the assumed use. And then there's kind of an architecture that's just for like mass production or to best utilize the space to in the most efficient way possible, which allows, as you maybe showed, for the user to actually interpret the space in the form of the castle or in the form of the gym or that. And I guess my question is, from your perspective, for the user of these spaces, do you have like kind of a decision as to what a more interesting or more important spatial configuration is, one that's prescribed or one that is kind of that stems from the user?
I think the answer would probably come from taking into account who the audience for the building is, because I think a lot of the possible alterations to space, I think, are cultural. Like people in Latin America are known for taking over not just their own space by adapting it to their own style or needs. As soon as the architect leaves, then the contractor takes over or the handyman takes over. Or taking over public space, you see a lot of street vendors that make a store out of the crosswalk coverage. But I don't see that as much in the US, and maybe it's because of the way that architecture has shaped the expectation of the American buyer. I think that maybe the American architect has done such a good job, because there's so much discourse here about architecture and urbanism, that maybe the dweller doesn't have to adapt it anymore. And at the most, you see people making an attachment to the house because they need an extra room, or converting the garage. But it's almost always hidden from the neighbors, because in the neighbors, and there's also zoning laws that keep people from expanding here because it ruins the plusvalía. It brings down the property value if some of the houses start not matching the others. I think there's a big priority in the aesthetics of architecture in the US to be similar, which is strange because you don't see it in fashion. Like the way fashion is marketed is to stand out and be individual, but the way that architecture is proposed to the American audience, I think, really celebrates that visual uniformity, and people like that, and then they find other ways to show their difference. And I don't know, I think that, I don't know, in Mexico, I think it's also economics, that if people will have enough money to build a one-story house, and then they'll save and save, and 5 years later they'll expand. My vote, ideally, would be that there's always room for growth, just like for a person or for a family, for an architectural building, a building that lets people, that's designed as a core skeleton, I think, that then later can expand to. It's a guarantee, I think, that people will be forever engaged to their space, or that the building will have an ongoing life and serve many purposes. There's actually a really excellent project you guys might be interested in by this guy. He won a MacArthur grant last year. It's Camilo Jose Vergara, and he's Chilean, but he shoots in New York, and he photographs the same building over maybe 30, 40 years. And you see the building. It was a church. It was a Pentecostal church, and then a little convenience store, and then it goes into a house, and you see all of the possible incarnations. He's shooting a lot in Harlem, and these places are not so regulated by zoning requirements. It's ideal to me if buildings can keep doing that. It happens, though. You see it in New York, I think, because of the real estate demands. Did that answer the question? I'm not an architect, so I'm just trying.
You said something rather interesting in the sense that you were reacting towards the photography and architectural photography, which were trying to mimic the rendering.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship between the rendering and architectural photography is a kind of a complex one at this moment. Since in a strange way, technically, the rendering has really taken the rendering already away before the rendering is taking photography away before it even happens, because it's trying to simulate photography. And clearly, up to now at least, in terms of renderings, if there even are people in the renderings, they are clearly related to the buyer's group. I think there is normally to 95% there are male, female, couple, in their 30s, 40s, at their absolute cusp of financial kind of abilities. And there's a tendency not only that you like seem to be looking at that, and clearly you're always particularly translating that into some kind of other group, which means either small children or elderly are a very large kind of audience. So can you elaborate on that a little bit? Like, why did you choose these?
I think in
particular groups,
yeah.
And they are, I mean, is there some kind of particular thinking about that represents the society as it is, or?
Yeah. In the case of these rendered characters that you see in architecture, it came to my attention this demographic that you see rendered when a friend of mine who was working for Fernando Romero in Mexico City, he's a very well-known architect, she was helping do his renderings, and they would cut out a lot of the people from Wallpaper magazine. And I thought, what? Like, this is so strange. You're making this for Mexicans. Like, these people don't look anything like people in Mexico, like your average Mexican. And soon after that, I was invited by Johnston Markley to make this intervention at the house, and I thought the last thing I want to happen is that this ends up looking like a wallpaper fashion shoot, or even like a Dwell magazine staging of an idyllic life. And I also, when I was in the house, I felt initially displaced because I couldn't imagine. Like, sometimes when I go into a space, I think, oh, I wonder, like, where would I put the bed, and where would I put the dining table? It's just kind of natural instinct. No, what would I do with this space? And there was something so strong about those colors, as you saw in the photographs, that at first, not alienated, but at first took more of my attention than the space itself. And I thought that that sense of distance that I initially got, I think, could best be conveyed by having an older generation come into a house that they wouldn't normally be targeted as clients for, and have them discuss the house and experience the house would enunciate even further the feeling of being in a house that is directed in the way it was. And in the case of the casting for 2 Million Homes for Mexico, I think that there's a little bit, it's a strange combination for me of the murals of Diego Rivera, where he takes the more indigenous Mexican and the way to get back to the roots of that pride that is sometimes missing is in the Diego Rivera mural, was by putting these people back into their native costume and saying, like, this is okay, we're proud of you, but it wasn't integrating them into the modern Mexican of the 1930s. And then you have, so that idea, that 1930s Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera idea of a future Mexico of equality involved the indigenous people dressed in their native costume and the European Mexican dressed as European, all hanging out together. And it's a very broad generalization, but then you get, so that's the characters, and then it's all gonna add up to something, I promise. And then you get the Julia Shulman introduction, or not the introduction, but the, he has the mic, basically, of modernism for Los Angeles. Because he's, unlike photography now that's so prevalent, that many people can go photograph a building and show you different aspects of it, Julia Shulman was the client, was the one photographer that had all the, like, most of the clients of that era. And you have, it's not the wallpaper magazine type of model, but you have, again, these photographs that show you how you could use the space and how your life could be of this quality and pragmatic glamour that the photographs communicate. And for 2 Million Homes, it's a little bit, I think, in very broad strokes, it's a little bit of a combination of thinking of what has happened to the working class Mexican that in the muralist paintings was depicted as coming hand in hand into the future, and now taking the same faces, we're looking at the descendants of a generation of a mestizo Mexican, and looking at where we have placed them, and a lot of the neighborhoods where the working class citizen is living is now in the outskirts of the city, so there's no longer that symbiosis of working class and the oligarch kind of keeping each other near because they need each other. And in the influence of the people being put in the spaces, again, it's almost like a review of where modernism got us, because from modernism, then came tract homes, again, in very big leaps. And from American tract homes, then you got the multifamily dwellings, like the extreme Cabrini Green situations. And these are ideas that got rejected from other countries that, curiously, Mexico still decided to bring over. So it's kind of a review of what happened to these people that we were, to the working class of Mexico that we had promised, and what kind of life is being had in this modern lifestyle that the developers promise. You see the advertisement for the homes, and it's very clear that the people are being sold this housing option as a more American way of life, where all the houses are the same. Hi. Yeah. There's not a lot of people behind you. It's only you.
Photographs seem very warm. I mean, this is a perfect example of the Peter Yellow in the painting. And then there's that picture of all the apartments, the yellow apartments with the sort of red brick colored roofs. And was that something? Did you use certain filters or did you shoot a certain lighting situation?
So funny. I was at a lecture last Monday, and this is Sylvia Lavin, she's an architecture critic, teacher, and she was talking about the three photographers that showed, and then she said, "And you, the Mexican, all that lusciousness." and then I thought it was funny because she reduced the two other photographers to some really basic, like, you're about this, and you're about this, and I got the lusciousness. And at that point, I had already presented it, and I sat down, and she was on this, so there's, you're not going to get into this banter. But I was thinking, well, did we get to thinking that less than ideal conditions come in desaturated black and white sepia tones? And I was thinking of the way that some people deal with economic scarcity, And the first thing you do is you paint your house purple in some of these houses in Mexico, and the better off people are, the more beige they get. And the worse of the more, and it's so, and some of these houses are painted in that peachy beige color that American tract homes are. And then little, and people are not allowed to paint them a different color, but then you see the new buildings painted, like, instead of peach, they'll be orange. And instead of beige, they'll be like a more brick-like beige. So the little, like, coating after coating, they start getting a little more saturated and a little more saturated. And do I use filters? I shoot analog, medium format, and large format. So 4x5 with those hood cameras, and 6x7, which is half the negative. And then I scan everything. And then I go on Photoshop, and I there's not a filter that I use. It's really just your palette. You know, when you're in Photoshop, you can, it's almost like being in the dark room, but instead of having 3-4 options for your palette, it's endless in Photoshop. And I think it's really, I can't help it. Cause I sometimes look I look at the colors of like South African photographers. And there's something very cool in the palette. And I mean cool as in the color temperature. And I just think and I know how to achieve that, but I don't think I can, like, after a while, the photo just seems like it doesn't work for, and it's just kind of like, that's just, I hate to say that upbringing has something like will shape you, but maybe, like, I grew up in Mexico, maybe, I don't know, maybe, like, we're a little more strident than some other places. So. Oh, and then, so it goes to digital, and then the output is analog again. So it just goes through this Photoshop process in between. But I do, all the capture is in, I'm not adding cats or extra people in post. It's all there. Hi.
I noticed on your first photographs in Mexico, the importance of signage and typography on houses, which is something that you see in the lower income areas in Mexico everywhere.
Totally. That's so funny you notice that, because it's in one of the things that I'm very drawn to in the 2 Million Homes for Mexico project is how living in those exact repeating conditions, like the neighborhood, the aerial, I don't know how to get to, will you help me even to get to the top of that photo? Right here, I can do it like this. Don't look, close your eyes. The aerial, here. The aerial shot, it's over here. Sorry, there we are. The aerial shot, you see, this is a neighborhood that has 47,000 homes that are built by 4 different developers, but they, with subtle variances. So imagine you move there when you're 8, and I come along when you're around 16, as in the case of this kid who's now the chef. And he's been living there for 8 years. He doesn't go into, this is a neighborhood that's by car. Coming south, it's 3 hours with commute, and without traffic, you can go in 40 minutes to the city. But if the parents are already working in the city, the last thing they want to do on the weekend is take the kids into the city. So a lot of your stimuli is coming from television, topography, which is computer rendered. And a lot of the, in terms of font usage, and a lot of the, just the visual experience is limited to the same type of house, with the exception of some of these. And in my interest of how this type of stimuli is manifested, I have noticed that some of the typography, unlike that old style of Mexican signage, where I don't know where everyone here is from, but I'm sure you've seen at some point tacos with legs or chickens with a Mike Tyson t-shirt on, and these are all paintings that you see in Mexican restaurants advertising food for sale. If there's a taqueria with, like, they'll sell tripe and they'll have a stomach with eyes and a happy face, or a podiatrist will have a foot that's happy next to a foot that's sad, and it'll say before and after. So there's a lot of humor and figuring out of a way of communicating that's original. And now I think with the prevalence of computers and also with the lack of stimuli, that these people are having a lot of the signage, as you suspect, has been reduced to the simple black paint instead of multicolors. And it's almost like Helvetica, like hand-painted Helvetica has come in. There's another one that, there's Helvetica. There's another one. Here we go. More computer font. I don't know if, here's another example of that mimesis, where people, I think, in the neighborhood start absorbing what they see, to the point where now this taqueria, it's a little portable taqueria, is named after the developer who has built most of these types of homes in Mexico. It's called Geo, Casas Geo. So now the taco stand, like, where is it going to, like, do you name your cat Geo? I've noticed taxi companies that are that are not government, they're private, and they're called Geo. I've seen mini stores called Geo. Here's another one. You see, it's caps. There's another, I don't think we have it. There's one of an internet cafe, which I thought was very curious, because there's also a car selling banana splits next to it. I don't think I have it, but again, think of the experience of a French patisserie in the way that you guys have sensed when you enter a pastry shop that's referencing France in any part of the country. At least there will be one miniature Eiffel Tower or a little French flag. And here, what people have been given visually is so reduced to the basic symbol of home, a door, a window, a parking spot, that I think it starts showing in the way that people give back visually. So now the French restaurant, the French pastry shop, this house has been converted into, has a man, a young boy dressed as a chef, when he's really just pouring he's not really cooking, he's just pouring the mix into the crepe machine. And just a sign. And I don't think people in that, young kids in the neighborhood will ever know where a crepe comes from, or that Serge Gainsborough sense of Frenchness. Like, it's completely just reduced to basics.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.